Thursday, May 14th on Connecticut Today. We gave you more coronavirus coverage as we carried portions of Governor Ned Lamont's daily coronavirus briefing, as we're just a few days away from the state's soft reopening on Wednesday, May 20th. Also on the show, we spoke to a gentleman from a legal foundation that represents workers not happy with their unions. He talked about a case recently decided that's got connections to a Connecticut nurse who worked for the state corrections department.
Amy Porter with us, a commissioner of aging and disability, because we are going to be focused on vulnerable populations today. And Dr. Coe is here on behalf of the reopening committee to take any questions you've got as reopening committee starts to wrap up its work aiming towards our May 20 date. Very quickly, I'll just show you on our daily summary. You could say the positive cases are up, but I'm a glass half full type of person. What that means is as a percentage of the tests performed, it's down and slightly under 10%, which is, again, a very important metric. And I'm very pleased that the number of tests you see are ramping up, 6,600. Tragically, another 94 fatalities, and that's up as well a little bit over the last few days. And current hospitalizations now in its third week of a downward progression, which is such an important metric for us. Let's just jump ahead now to what we need to do to protect the most vulnerable of our populations. That's important, as we've said before, because it's the right thing to do. You know, African Americans are much more likely to be infected, much more likely to suffer real complications. And it's also important to do when you look at the fact that it's in certain areas that you have the most risk of a flare-up. Look at the congregate housing here, for example. Who do we need to protect? The congregate housing. You know, that's assisted living. That's prisons. That's nursing homes. These are the groups that are really important that we keep them protected, which is part of what our testing protocol is going to be and why we focus on that. Frontline workers. You know, look at the nurses, the first responders, our officials, public safety. They're the folks interfacing every day, often with these vulnerable populations. These are folks we're going to take a special effort to protect. Racial and ethnic minorities, as I suggested before, particularly vulnerable, because they have some pre-existing conditions, but also densely populated communities, those that live in areas where it's not easy to socially distance, where you have more people in a home. Those are the populations we're really going to focus on when it comes to testing, when it comes to the support groups. And finally, that group that is high risk due to age. Unfortunately, I am in that category. And people over the age of 60, 65, they should be staying at home. Even as we slowly think about reopening parts of our economy, they should be staying close to home. And those, again, that have some of the pre-existing conditions, especially that which impacts the lungs, say asthma, those are the things that give you the greatest risk. And those are the people we need to protect. So our priorities when it comes to testing is vastly ramping up our testing, mass testing in those most vulnerable populations, focusing on them both in terms of symptomatic, those who have the symptoms of COVID, flu-like symptoms, and also those who are asymptomatic. So we can make an extra effort to make sure that those populations are safe. That's how we reach the vulnerable. And then Amy will help us describe how we support the vulnerable once we find out what that status is. So testing, how do we ramp up our testing? As you know, over the last few days, we've described some of the partnerships we have, Yale New Haven, Jackson recently here, Genesis Diagnostics, Hartford Healthcare, Quest. These are all groups that are going to allow us to ramp up our testing. We said we'd be doing 42,000 tests a week starting next week, and Josh is highly confident we're going to blow through that number. And I think it's really important and ramp up towards 100,000 and beyond in June. I can't overemphasize how important testing is, but testing is only works if you're willing to get tested. And right now, as you know, we have a lot of capacity at our hospitals, a lot of capacity still at our drive-through facility in New Haven. You probably heard we're going to be rolling out additional testing facilities in our partnership with CVS. I think another 12 pharmacies be up and operating very soon to make testing more easily available for each and every one of you. We're rolling out on our community health centers so that the most vulnerable populations in those tougher neighborhoods can know they can get tested, they can get tested safely, they can get tested without cost, and no cost for treatment. And finally, we're working closely with our churches as well as the community centers. Senator McCrory has helped us there as well as we try and get the message out how it's important that you go out and do that testing, and the pharmacies allow us to take the test to you. So when it comes to our priority, when it's mass testing, here we are at the Phillips Health Center in Hartford's North End. This is the program that Doug McCrory helped us put together. They already have 300 people who have been tested to date, and we're ramping that up, and it's really important. How do we reach the vulnerable? How do we reach out to them? You know, there we're working, as I said before, with some of our fellow stakeholders, starting with the churches. Multilingual, you're going on radio and other broadcast media, Spanish, English. Go where people are and tell them what this means to you and your family and what it means to your greater community. We'll be supplementing that with more public service advertising. And there you see our contact tracing, which I think we have a chance to talk about in a minute. Support for the vulnerable. You know, here Amy's team is helping to take the lead, because if you're tested and you're found to be COVID infected, your test positive, what do we do for you? Does it mean you just by yourself and self-quarantine and work? No. If you're in a crowded situation, we provide you housing support at one of the local hotels in particular. We provide food support for you. We've really ramped that up courtesy of Brian Hurlbut, our commissioner of agriculture. We're able to deliver, Amy says, I think it's hundreds of meals now a day here just in the greater Hartford area to those who are in the hotel or those who are self-quarantined for one reason or another. The medical support is so key as well. And I think there you're going to find that we're ramping that up, and I'll get to that in a second. And finally, the COVID care kit we'll talk about. Next slide, please. A lot of talk about our reopening metrics and where do we stand on that. And I was accusing Josh of a little bit of grade inflation today, but he's explained to me that I think we're doing pretty well in these metrics. Obviously, we're way beyond a 14-day decline in hospitalizations. I think you're seeing that we're going to not only test 42,000 and beyond next week. I think on the contact tracing, there's a question about what is sufficient. But, you know, Dr. Koh was saying a contact tracer can maybe take on 10 or 12 new clients a day. And given that number, we have over 300 volunteers right now working through our local health department. So that would mean we could handle, starting right now, say 3,000 folks who are tested positive on a daily basis. That's one definition of sufficient. I think we described a little bit what we're doing for the vulnerable populations, and we can always do more. Healthcare capacity and PPE, we've talked a lot about why we think we're in strong position there. Finally, so far, appropriate physical distancing regulation, I think we've been strong on, and I've been really proud of the people of Connecticut to follow that. But I also worry, this is a place where you can fall backwards. This is a place where you look around the country, you see it's not just in a nursing home, it's not just in a prison where you have a flare-up. You see Tokyo, no, it was South Korea, Seoul, I think it was, where one super spreader went to several nightclubs and infected many, many people. I saw that in Wisconsin yesterday, the day before, the Supreme Court lifted the stay-at-home regulations and, you know, hundreds piled into the bars. So appropriate physical distancing regulations, that's one I watch like a hawk going forward. With that, I'd just really like to ask Amy Porter to say a few things about where we are on these vulnerable populations, and then we're all here to take your questions. Dr. Koh is here and Paul Mounds as well. Amy?
Thank you, Governor, and thank you for having me here today. Protecting our at-risk populations is something that is a significant priority for the administration. We've been working across state agencies, across the administration. We've been working with state and local health partners. We've been working with community organizations to address the needs of specific populations. I have been fortunate to work on the Reopen Community Committee, and it is an incredible group of people. It is chaired by Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith, who is the Director of Equity Research and Innovation at the Yale School of Medicine. We also have members, a pretty diverse set of members. Marie Allen is the Executive Director of the Southwestern Connecticut Area Agency on Aging and Independent Living. Dr. Ken Aline is the Vice Chair of the Connecticut Health Foundation. Nora Duncan, the State Director of Connecticut AARP. Rochelle Palash is the Assistant District Leader for an SEIU local. Daria Smith, the Executive Director of the Connecticut State Independent Living Council. Mike Frieda from the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities. And then we're also joined by three of our fellow commissioners, Commissioner Gifford, Commissioner Scheff, and Commissioner Delphin Rittman. This group of individuals has spent an enormous amount of time trying to identify the needs, trying to listen to the voices in the community, and they all bring their own extensive networks of folks. When the governor talks about outreach and having people go out and speak to the communities, these are all individuals with their own incredible networks, and they're all incredibly committed to going out and having these conversations, figuring out the key messages so that as we ramp up the contact tracing, as we think about more people in quarantine and isolation who might need supports, we can encourage people to do that knowing that we're going to have the system in place. If somebody needs access to housing, as the governor said, if they need access to food, if they're trying to figure out, I have symptoms, but I'm not sure if they're significant enough, and I don't have a doctor. I don't have a place to go. So making sure that people are connected with active clinical monitoring and really the tools that they need through a care kit, like a thermometer, a pulse oximeter, masks, emergency information, educational materials about what to do as symptoms progress. So that's all the pieces that we're ramping up to make sure that folks that are in quarantine and isolation are supported as we move forward.
Well, thank you, Amy. Any questions, Max?
The Connecticut Mirror.
Good afternoon. Governor, you are, I assume, in receipt of a letter from 11 Democratic state senators, which I won't go into all the letter because it is chock full of questions. But first question, do you have a general response to their concern, which is quite simply that they have doubts that the state is ready, that they don't have confidence that the metrics for how to judge when it's safe to reopen and remain open have been defined. They also have questions about the availability of testing and contact tracing. So could you please give a response to that?
I think they should listen to our briefings here. I think Dr. Koh and his team helped put together a set of metrics. I believe the Senate Democrats thought the metrics were really appropriate. Then we've tried to do on at least a weekly basis, as we did today, to show you where we stand on each of those metrics. Maybe they wanted more testing, but we've far exceeded what we planned to do. And maybe they want more contact tracing, but we tried to say we have more than enough to handle everybody we find to be infected now. Can we always do more? Yeah, I appreciate the ongoing concern that people have. But I think we've got the right balance going forward right now. I think you have a sense that we put public health and public safety first and foremost. And whatever we do, we're doing very cautiously.
At least two of those people on that letter were people who have participated in your briefings, and they're generally complimentary of the advisory group, even as they raise these questions. But to what extent does this? Let me ask another question. When it comes to contact tracing, Joe Brennan, the CBIA president, on the business roundtable call earlier today, he offered another concern about contact tracing. And his concern was once Connecticut reopens businesses, that it'll be very important if there is any outbreaks to be able to accurately and quickly trace the source. Otherwise, the fear is that you will have to close businesses again, which his view would be that would be disastrous. So can you address the question of how important it would be for contact tracing to be done to make sure that there's a confidence that businesses are safe places for people to come in as consumers and to be there as workers?
Yeah, I think nobody takes that more seriously than the businesses themselves. I think they know that if their restaurant or their barbershop, we found that there was an infection there, what that would mean in terms of business, what that would mean in terms of their employees, what that would mean towards the entire perception. So we've got very strict protocols for each and every one of these facilities. Most of them PAS are by appointment only, so we'll know exactly who is in and out of those facilities. And, you know, I've heard from some of the folks in the legislature, maybe you're going too fast. I heard from 130 restaurants yesterday, you're going too slow. We're trying to get a balance going forward to keep you safe first and foremost and convince you that on all these key metrics, which we described at the beginning of this session, we're taking your health first and foremost.
And the last thing is, one of the questions was about looking at your approach to statewide standards as opposed to Governor Cuomo, who's now talking about differentiating reopening based on county. What's your latest thinking on that? Do you still see Connecticut as just too small to go on a county-by-county basis, or are you open to perhaps some differentiation by county?
At this point, I just think we're too small. I mean, to go to Lake Erie is a six-hour drive, but if you're in New Haven, you can get to any part of the state in an hour or so. We're a relatively small state, so the idea that you would open up a restaurant here or not there, or a hair salon here but not there, I think the possibility is promoting a lot of traffic back and forth. But, you know, frankly, we can always take a second look at that as we see what transpires going forward. But that's my strong inclination so far. And frankly, it was a strong inclination of the Reopen Connecticut Committee who I listened to.
Thank you.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Hello, how's everybody today? My question is, I did sit on the round table today, and it's clear that the Department of Economic Development and everyone, all the partners on the committee have been working to put this plan together. But a lot of businesses, restaurants and hair salons, many may decide not to reopen next week because they just can't institute and implement all of the things. What kind of message do you think that will send to people that it's still not safe or it's going to get better?
I think it would send the opposite message, that these restaurants or salons are very thoughtful. They're only going to open when they're absolutely ready. And if they want to take an extra week or two, I think that's totally appropriate. And I think we've seen that around the country.
And my other question is more on the lines, kind of what Mark had said, the confidence level. You know, after reading some of these guidelines, and albeit safe, smart, practical, you know, people going to restaurants with masks on and having to wear them at table, that's difficult, isn't it?
Well, that's one reason we didn't like indoor dining, and we thought outdoor dining was an awful lot safer. And if you're implying, you know, if they wear a mask, will that make people more anxious about going there? I think just the opposite. It would say to me that this is a facility that takes the protocols very seriously. Dr. Coe, do you want to add anything to that question?
Yeah, I think what we know and you know, what we've known from outbreaks throughout the world, but also here in the United States, is that it's really being indoors in confined spaces, which is problematic and has the higher risk. When you're outside, you have hundreds of liters of air exchange coming through, the risk is really quite mitigated. And so that was, I think, behind the Reopen Connecticut Advisory Board, but also the state's recommendations to, you know, have outdoor activities, just as we're doing with biking and hiking, but also outdoor activities, whether it's outdoor restaurants, this is kind of the same logic. And I think also the other, you know, issue, and just to reinforce what the governor had said, is that in the criteria, the guiding principles for reopening for phase one, choice is an important one. So those restaurants, those businesses that are not feel that they can, you know, go on these guidelines, which are actually quite well developed by our
What happened?
He was making an excellent point, but maybe we should keep going for a second. Max?
We will get back to Dr. Coe.
Thank you.
For now, we will move along next to NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon. Sticking with the restaurant question, this afternoon during the roundtable, or this morning, I should say, the Connecticut Restaurant Association brought up the point that there are a lot of restaurants that are being left out of this May 20th opening just by the fact that they may not have a patio. They're urging the state to allow limited indoor seating and dining beginning June 3rd. Do you think that's feasible? And if not, when can we expect that to start to happen?
My instinct is that it's early, and I want to see a little more experience with the outside dining first. I've been impressed, though. I mean, Sarah Bronin here in Hartford, Freddie Camillo down in Greenwich, people are thinking really creatively about how to close down some roads to traffic, open up more for pedestrian traffic, more room for outdoor seating. I think it could be very interesting over the course of the next month, and we'll learn a lot.
And secondly, now that we're getting some nicer weather, a lot of parents want to know, when will the local playground be open? Will the pools open this summer? Where does that fall in your phases, and will you be leaving that decision ultimately up to the municipalities?
Right now, that's a decision that's left up to the municipalities. They control their local parks and the access there. But my instinct is that could be, since it's outside, we can do it carefully. If they have people there that can clean off the swing set, We could do that perhaps in the next round, but maybe Paul or Dr. Coe would have an insight there.
We've talked to these people a couple of times over the past year or so. The Fairness Center, legal organization that represents people who feel they've been wronged in labor situations, especially by unions. And there's a couple of cases, a couple of things we wanted to update you on. Nathan McGrath joins us. We spoke to Nathan a few months ago. He is VP and Director of Litigation at the Fairness Center. The website, by the way, is Fairness Center. Run it all together, fairnesscenter.org. Nathan, Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport. Good to have you on again. How are you?
Hi, Paul. How are you doing this afternoon?
We're okay. I'm ensconced in my son's old bedroom when he was a kid, so I'm doing the show from just off the left side of my bathroom. But I'm okay. I'm socially distancing. And everything
we're
is
leading the bunker life here, too.
Yes, so. Right. I can imagine. It's amazing all the conveniences I have here, an executive washroom, a kitchen, and everything. It's amazing.
It's a one-stop shop here.
You wanted to update us on a couple of things. This first case involving a nurse in state corrections, Cheryl Spano Lonis, or Lonis, forgive me, I don't know how her name is pronounced.
Lonis, I believe, yeah.
Lonis, yeah, and you were involved in this case. Tell us a little about that.
Right. So this case was really interesting. She was a nurse practitioner for the Connecticut Department of Corrections. And so she basically cared for and assisted with inmate health care, basically. And a number of years ago, in fact, back in 2015, she got reconnected with her church, and she started looking at what her union was spending her union dues on.
Yeah.
And it just did not, you know, match up with her beliefs anymore. And so she went to her collective bargaining agreement and realized that she could leave the union. And once she did that, back in that day before the Janus decision, she could then send her union fees to a charity of her choice. So, okay. You know, trying to comply with the rules, she sent in her resignation and she said, you know, I'd like to send my money to charity. And the union basically said, yeah, no, we don't think so. And she kept after it to her credit for about three years. And one point in 2016, they said, oh, okay, well, let's have a meeting. We're going to talk with you about your religious beliefs. And so the union grilled her on her religious beliefs and, you know, whether she was really, you know, practicing Christian or something like that. But they still took no action. And so it took 3 years for her to get out of the union. And then with our help, we actually helped her get about $2,500 back to her that should have never been taken from her in the first place.
There is a quote from her, Nathan, on your website. She says, quote, union officials treated me like an ATM. They ignored their own rules, violated my rights, and misused my money. I did everything I could to ensure my money wasn't used by union officials for purposes that violate my moral and religious beliefs. So I guess the union brass, and by the way, this is SEIU, New England, District 1199, very powerful union, as we all know. What do they do, Nathan? They just thumb their nose at that?
Yeah, and you know, one of the reasons we wanted to talk with you about this case was her case is just very emblematic of what public employees are facing in Connecticut, in Pennsylvania, another state where we work, but really all over the U.S. where they have certain convictions or beliefs, and they're trying to leave their union right now for whatever reason, and unions are just stonewalling them. And what we've seen happen over and over again for years now is that the unions will either completely ignore the person or they'll just flat out say no, and anything in between as well happens. And they just hope this person goes away. And then the person often will get really frustrated and they will go away because they're like, who's there to help me? And a few of these folks, though, are able to find, you know, our law firm and some other folks that do work like us. And we actually are able to file lawsuits for them or write a letter for them. And the unions then quickly cave. Is our experience, because they don't really want to fight this battle. They were hoping the person would go away.
Now, but you probably know, and let me take this from the other side, Nathan. Nathan McGrath, by the way, joins us, lead litigator at the Fairness Center. I've heard from friends of mine who are in unions. I'm not in a union now, by the way. I used to be at one time. My son is in one. And they say, well, listen, a part of what we have done for this individual to ensure the health and safety on the workplace, to ensure a fair wage and a fair contract, you know, that was our doing. So how does this individual get away with working in a union workplace yet not contributing to the union? I'm sure you've heard that numerous times, Nathan, both, you know, in pretrial conferences and then in court. What's your answer to that? And what do some of your clients say to that?
Yeah, we hear that a lot, actually. And one of the first responses that often will come out of my client's mouth is, I never asked for the union to speak for me. I never wanted them to speak for me. But, you know, many, many state, well, in fact, I almost can't think of any public employee position that there isn't a union. If anyone wants to be employed there, they have to be part of a bargaining unit. And that is, whether you're in the union or not, the union represents you. They're called the exclusive rep, and they are the only people that can speak for you to your employer. And so whatever they decide, whether they're good or bad working conditions, they're jammed down your throat and you're forced to accept it, whether you wanted to or not. And these employees have completely lost their voice because the unions, being the exclusive rep, have a lot of authority and power. So they like that. They like having these people as in their bargaining unit, and they're the only conduit to the employer. And in fact, the federal courts have even recognized really having a bargaining unit and being the exclusive rep is actually payment enough for these unions because of the great power that they wield because of that situation alone. And in fact, a federal court has even gone as far as to say that's payment enough that they've given up their ability to speak with their employer, and the union is in that position alone. So, I would just say, you know, number one, our clients didn't ask for the union to negotiate on their behalf. And number two, since the unions are in that position, our clients have already paid them enough by giving up their freedom of speech and their ability to negotiate with their employer. They're forced into this situation.
Yeah, Nathan, also, isn't part of this, and I've heard this from union people on both sides of the aisle, isn't a lot of the sticking point here coming around what is done with their union dues? In other words, I know people who may have been in your client's position who said, listen, you know, I understand the union's important. It does give us protections, but I don't like, from a political point of view, where my union dues are donated. I'm pro-life. I don't want money given to NARAL. I'm pro-gun. I don't want my money given to anti-gun groups. Isn't this a major root cause of this whole thing?
I would say so. I think that often if unions would just stay out of the business of politics, pretty much everyone would want to be part of a union, you know, if they offer good value. But the political thing is a real sticking point. Let me give you a great example of this,
sure.
Actually. I had a client out on the West Coast, and he told me one day, he said, you know, I agree with everything, single thing the union stands for and every political candidate that they support. But you know what? It should be me who writes the check to that person, not the union on my behalf.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
why he retained me to represent him, because even though he agreed politically with the union, he felt that he should be the one making that, you know, support and that representation and not the union on his behalf. So even a situation like that where the union might be aligned with its membership, they're still basically dictating and directing these funds. And these people say, hey, you know, this is valuable to me that I actually have a say over who I support in politics.
Yeah, sure, because, again, Nathan, I think most people would realize, okay, the union boss has to get paid, and there's a union hall that we have to maintain, and the union does have a retirement fund that has to be administrated, and, you know, they do set up health benefits for us, and the union does this and that. But I think they draw a line there, as your client did in that case, between looking out for my well-being as a union worker versus taking my money and telling other people who to vote for.
Yeah. I had another client who the reason she left the union and enlisted our help was because she, you know, was okay with what the union was doing in her workplace. But then she found out thousands and thousands of their money was getting shipped out of state into a political cause in a different state. And she
yeah.
said, now, wait a second. What is that doing for me and for what I'm about here? She was a teacher, and she said, how is that helping teachers in our state? How's that helping our students?
Nathan McGrath joins us. We've spoken to him a few times over the past year, VP and Director of Litigation. So we talked about Cheryl Spanel, Lonis, her case, Lonis. Janice versus AFSCME. I remember last time we spoke, Nathan, this was a point of contention, and I guess this is still going. And to frame this, if you would, Nathan, please explain to my listeners what the Janus decision was meant to do from the U.S. Supreme Court and what roadblocks it's actually running into when it happens or it's brought up in certain states.
The Janus v. AFSCME decision was handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court on June 27th, 2018, so about 2 years ago, and the end of the day holding was fairly simple. It's that the Supreme Court held that public employees who are not members of a union cannot be forced to pay union dues or fees as a condition of their employment. Prior to this, there were state laws and CBA provisions that said even if you are not a member of the union, but you work in a bargaining unit, you still have to pay the union a certain amount of fees that, oddly enough, the union got to decide for itself. So Janice simply said, if you're not a member, you obviously aren't agreeing or wanting the union to spend your money on political things, so you don't have to pay them anything.
I know, though, in several states, Nathan, there are some states, state legislatures, and state units, state bargaining units with the government unions who are pushing back on this. And simply, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've read cases where they're just not paying attention to a Supreme Court ruling.
Well, that's true. So the Janus decision came down, and one may think, oh, well, the Supreme Court has spoken. Everyone will just comply and follow along. That is not the case, actually. In fact, I think the latest number that I've seen, at least, is there's about 90 follow-up cases to Janus trying to enforce people's rights and to really kind of test the bounds, I suppose, of what the Supreme Court has said. But part of the litigation that's come out of this is that unions have realized, well, for people to claim their Janus rights, they have to be non-members. They have to get out of the union. So we're going to start throwing up a lot of roadblocks to getting out of the union. And so our firm, I think, has had at least 15 clients alone just facing this situation. And by and large, we've been able to assist them getting out of the union and to not have to pay the union dues like they had wanted. But yeah, the unions are really putting up a fight to this, and there's a lot of litigation going on all over the country on this. And as an example, we have a situation in Pennsylvania where the PSEA, which is the state affiliate of the NEA, which is the National Education Association, they and their local unions are still negotiating in fair share fee provisions in collective bargaining agreements. So if you're a good teacher at a school district and you say, you know, I'm not a member of the union, I disagree with them, or I don't, you know, want to pay them for whatever reason, and you go to your collective bargaining agreement, the old language, which has been, you know, the concept, the principle, has been deemed unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, it's still there. So if you look at it and you go, well, I guess I still have to pay. I mean, these people could be totally buffaloed because these provisions are still being negotiated in. And we actually have a case before the Third Circuit right now where our clients are basically pleading with the court, like, please have Pennsylvania law line up with the Janus decision, because people could really have, you know, be fooled by this right now. There's still a law on the book that runs contrary to the Janus decision.
What happens, Nathan, and about the minute we have left here as we have to wrap up, what happens if you or somebody from your organization, if you take a client like this and you contact the union and say, look, okay, you're dealing with us now. This is what we do for a living. You know that's bull crap, and you know that the Janus decision overrides what you have in there. You know, give this woman just let her cut loose. What's the point here? Do they back off at that point, or do some unions just gird even more for a fight?
I would say in this lane of litigation, by and large, if we show up on the job, we've been able to get our clients fairly quick relief, because I think the unions don't really want to push this through the court system. So
it's fascinating stuff. And Nathan, I would assume that if people think they have a case, they can contact your organization, correct?
Absolutely. We'd love to hear from them.
Okay. Fairnesscenter.org. Check them out, folks. You can make a contact there if you think you have a problem, or if you just want to read about some of the cases. It's fascinating, educational stuff. Fairnesscenter.org. Nathan McGrath is the VP and Director of Litigation. Nathan, good luck in the future. Stay safe, and hopefully we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thanks, Nathan.